Northwest Orbit on Space 101.1 FM.
Space 101.1 KMGP LPFM Magnuson Park. My name is Mitch Etter and this is Northwest Orbit. We're doing something different on the show today. Normally I play music from local artists across all of the Northwest. Sometimes I'll play live recordings from bands that Space has produced, or occasionally I'll air like 10-minute interview snippets. Today on the show, though, the whole hour is going to be an exclusive interview with Benjamin Verdos of the Mount St. Helens Vietnam Band. I invited him to chat for one of our typical interview segments, and we just had such a great free-flowing conversation that went long and covered a lot of interesting topics. So for anyone who's a musician, there's some wisdom to be heard here. For people who are interested in music history and what it's like to be a small band that gets a big break, I think this is a good chat. In a moment, I'll air that interview with Benjamin Verdos, but first I want to give a short background on the band, play a song by them to familiarize yourself with what they do, and then you'll hear my chat with Ben. If you're hearing this on the radio, by the way, this is a truncated version of the interview in order to fit my hour time slot. The whole interview is available in full at space101fm.org under the Northwest Orbit Artist Interview subsection. All right, real quick, the 60-second history of this band is that the Mount St. Helens Vietnam Band began in 2008, started at its core as a family band with Benjamin on vocals and guitar, his young teenage brother, Marshall, on the drums, and Ben's then-wife, Tracy, playing keys. Within a few weeks of their very first concert, they were signed to Dead Oceans. If you're unfamiliar with Dead Oceans, this is the same label that assigned Phoebe Bridgers, Kroonbin, Bright Eyes, Japanese Breakfast, Mitski, many others. It's a big deal to get signed by them. The band released an album, they tour the country, opening for their heroes, release another album very quickly, and then an EP. And after various interpersonal struggles, the band went away for about a decade. And now they're back, recording music, and we chat about all of that in this hour. We'll hear that interview again in just a second. First, let's listen to their top song on Spotify. This is Albatross, Albatross, Albatross.
We'll be right back.
Now, my interview with Benjamin Verdos of the Mount St. Helens Vietnam Band. So I would love to start with the origin story of Mount St. Helens Vietnam Band, because I've read online about kind of the early internet buzz, which stemmed from not releasing music and just kind of being silly online. But I've never really heard the story directly from you guys, just in print.
Yeah.
Do you mind telling us about kind of those band beginnings and what that did for the band?
Yeah, it was a really unique time. And I mean, I guess I've thought about it a lot because the last couple of years, because I've been kind of like trying to frame all of that stuff from like being removed from it a little bit. Strangely, like I feel like the shift, it was like Obama got elected. There was like a lot, bands were like really like kind of fun for it in that era. It's like there was like all these like I feel like the Strokes and like the early 2000s leading up to it was like a lot of dance rock and like whatever. It was like there's like a certain optimism that is funny to look back on at in some regards, but I think that coincided with like this personal like amount of like just not caring for the first time in my life, and then also being married to someone who was like really into emerging tech and literature and stuff. So it was kind of like a combination of a few things, but I would say that the onset of MySpace is like really, that was it for a lot of people. And for us, it was largely like, that era is like, as far as like what you're referencing with like our origins and like not releasing music, it was an accident basically. So so rewind the tape a little bit. Marshall and I, my brother, who I was like co-raising with my biological mother, he's adopted, and I was teaching him to play drums, and I had like been in all these bands that were like kind of like, again, like I was saying, like more serious, and I was serious, and the bands, everyone was trying to kind of do things, and it was great. It's where you learn everything, but I was like very disillusioned with it all, and so it wasn't fun anymore. So I was like, all right, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm just going to play music with my little brother who I've been teaching to play drums. He's really good, and it felt like pure. So I was like, all right, we'll do this. We had these little riffs. He'd be like, when are we going to start a band? When are we going to start a band? And by the time he came to live with me full time, we had like, you know, it had been like maybe at least a couple years of us like, you know, playing little riffs and whatever. And I was like, yeah, we'll start a band when you're ready, you know, when you're good enough. And he was like a little kid, but he was pretty good, you know? So I was like, all right, we'll do a band. And when are we gonna play a show? Cause he would come to all my shows growing up. And so I was like, yeah, we'll do a show when you're ready. So then at a certain point, you know, he came to live with me full time. I got married, just like kind of fast forwarding. And then, I was like, all right, we'll play a show and we'll start a band. You got to name it. So as the story goes, he came up with all the worst band names you could ever imagine that were just like derivative of bands that he had knew of. And we were driving in Stanwood, which is where we were living at the time. And I said, you got to name your band. If we're going to play this show. And he said, Mount St. Helens Vietnam Band, all in one thing. And I was like, all right, man, whatever. Cause I mean, I had no expectations about, I mean, it's absurd. So it made sense in that. And that was, again, the times, like, people just were naming bands ridiculous things. So I was like, whatever, it's as good as anything. So MySpace existed. My, like, wife at the time, Tracy, like, she would create me, like, Facebook pages. She created me a Twitter. She was really into all that stuff, which is really cool. I was a little bit, like, of a Luddite, and I would email and I'd play Words with friends, but anyway, she got me kind of like into it. And so enough to where she's like, hey, I created as a MySpace page. Cause I was like, I don't think she was in the band yet, but we did like, we were like starting to brainstorm. I was like, okay, it's a band. Marshall named it. And then I was like, you should be in the band. She was really reluctant. And that's what happened. And she was like, whatever. And so we took photos in our living room in front of these curtains with a Polaroid, put them all together. She made a MySpace page. And then people were really intrigued by it. So it was like a joke, essentially, in a lot of ways. But then people were like writing us because we were friending all these people. It wasn't like, it was so new that it was, there weren't like a code of ethics, which came later, I think, feel like with a lot of social media. But we were just like spamming people and then friending them. And then we said we were a band. We might have had like one demo, but we basically didn't have any music on. So people were like, where's the music? It was an innocent time. And we're like, it's coming. We'll get it. And then we realized that it was just one of those discoveries. You're like, oh, people want what they can't have. So we just played it up. We ran with it. And then I think we released like a snippet of a song. But we did it with these PSAs because I was working. Oh, so yeah. I think this is more or less accurate. I mean, so I was working at Stanwood High School at the time, and the Reading Rainbow videos were on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I would watch those with the kids I worked with. I worked in like a special ed department. And so they were just like on in the background, but I kind of get sucked into it. And I was like, oh, I love Reading Rainbow. And I was like, there's something about like that aesthetic too. It was like, it was funny, and like Tim and Eric was out. Like there was just all these things happening. So like for whatever reason, we were like, you know what? Let's make PSAs. Let's make these weirdo PSAs. And that will kind of like reach out. We'll be able to like tell people in a weird way. And then like, we'll put clips of music in that. And so that's what we did. So the first one was called Homeostasis. It still exists. Some of them are lost forever, which is really sad. The pinnacle of all of the videos got like, what is it? DMCA'd.
Oh yeah.
And we didn't have a backup. It was just like, oh, it's heartbreaking because it was like really epic. And I'll tell you about it at some point if you want to know, but Homeostasis was like, basically I was like, okay. Cause I was watching this video. I was like, you have a word to teach people, you know, a theme or some subject, scientific thing. And so I thought it'd be funny just to be like, oh, we're this weird band. This little kid in it. It's absurd. You can't be serious with something like this. And I was coming from like math rock bands and where I was just like, I just don't care about any of it. So I was like, homeostasis is like supposed to be a joke about like how like finally there's something different, you know, in the music scene. And we were challenging people to accept, you know. And so anyways, really stupid. But Marshall was like the star of it. And there's like pizzas flying by and all this stupid shit. And just the worst low bit, like, you know, like, resolution, whatever it's called. And yeah, that was it. We just put it up and started sending it to people. And like at that time, getting like, you know, thousands of views was like getting millions of views. Like virality in Seattle, that was like a thing. I mean, we definitely were like had a somewhat of a moment. People were talking about it. And then we started posting more stuff, snippets of songs. And then that's kind of like the general thing. And then the last thing is it like, so the whole idea that what really set things going other than those videos is like, even then we were like, well, but we're trying to get to open a show, or I was going to book us a show. At this point, I've been booking shows for years, so I knew more or less how it worked. So I was like, okay, we want to play at Numo's. I wanted Marshall. He was like 11, 12. Like I wanted him to think that it was like a real show, like at a really cool venue. And so I was like, I love Numo's. It sounds the best. Like it was like popping at the time. So, we scheduled, we scheduled, or I wrote the booker and I was like, hey, I want to put together a show. And I had been writing all these bands that were kind of cool at the time that were more popular than us. And we just wanted to open it. Mm-hmm. Like we didn't like, it wasn't, the master plan was like very incomplete. Long story short, we asked like Natalie Portman Shaved Head, which their manager wrote back and said, you know, sorry, they can't do it, but we've heard of you guys. We understand. Cause I mean, think about, again, it's like you couldn't have a better pairing of like a silly band. Mm-hmm. That were like, you know, at that time you could call yourself Natalie Portman Shaved Head, and it was funny. You know, there are a lot of bands like that. I'm sure you could list like 20 of them. But so we were like, all right, we're gonna try to do this. We asked a bunch of bands, and we got someone to commit, and then Steven Severin, who was doing the talent binding, was like, all right, he wrote me back, which is crazy, but he was like, all right, this is interesting. We don't usually book shows as far in advance. I followed up as soon as he said with like the window that I could do it. He's like, all right, I'll give you a hold, you know, on the date. Mm-hmm. And because it sounded intriguing, because we had like a good lineup, so to speak, in theory. Anyway, put together. He's like, cool, sounds good. And then we basically confirmed it. And then the headlining band dropped off. I think we were going to do main support. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh shit, well, we'll just take the show. So anyway, the whole story goes on and on and on and on until, you know, until you stop asking questions. You probably don't only have like three of your next questions covered, but the idea though was like just using MySpace, telling people, and then just like, and then the master plan was to have this big show rather than just like start playing little shows in the scene. We're like, fuck it, let's just do, sorry, can I swear in here?
Yeah, you're good.
We're like, we're just going to book the biggest thing and just like make it absurd. And it's going to be called the world premiere show. And so that's like, that's essentially the groundwork for how that whole thing happened.
So all this is kind of like, there's silliness and taking it non-seriously in the back of your mind. But I get the sense that there is some kind of like purpose behind it. You're wanting to 100%. Show Marshall that this is like,
oh yeah,
of making it the best experience possible for him. So a couple right. Like quick follow-up things. Yeah. And some of the, yeah, so like when sure. You were saying you were just like spamming people on MySpace, mm-hmm. Following people, were these just randoms or were you like, I'm going to follow the head of Columbia Records. I'm going to follow Rick Rubin, whoever the people are.
Yeah, it's a good question. We definitely followed people. Again, like my, Tracy was like really instrumental in that. Like she would like be like messaging people, following people and researching people. She really liked being like an internet sleuth or whatever.
Yeah.
And prided herself on it, which again wasn't my thing, but I learned a lot from her. I always really credit her as being like a big influence on like how I started to see the emergence of like social networks and stuff. Cause I was like in the music scene where you did everything was really like, you know, so this is like a whole new like kind of situation. And so basically, we did, yeah, we would write people. We had a lot of friends in the music scene, but I think she would follow people from labels, anyone and everyone. And then, so to your point though, or to your question, some people really started to get mad at us very early. And one of them was this guy named Eric Grandy, who we just really, like, I personally just kind of hated anyway. Cause he was just like, he was like the opposite of what we were. He was like supposed to be cool. He was like the Pitchfork kind of like, that whole like the emerging, there's like the cuteness and the fun world in that time, and there was the emerging dark cloud of Pitchfork, and where the cruelty behind like what music journalism was something that those things would converge in an amazing way. So I remember him. The reason I say it is because he once said something about keeping your memes off my lawn or something. I didn't really understand it, but I was like, he was clearly like, maybe they're innocent enough, but they're annoying the shit out of me. And you know, I'm not so much now, I don't think, but I, at that time I was like, oh, we didn't know we were doing anything wrong, but people were really, really interested in us, and that made some bands like really like, why are they're scammers? And then it made like kind of these like legit people in the music scene really skeptical. And yeah, it's probably honestly not that big of a deal in general, but at the time that was our world. It felt very polarizing and we felt like we were onto something. It's like, if people hate you, people are weird about it, then you must be doing something right.
No, that makes perfect sense. It's the first gatekeeper to kind of like where you don't have a wall built up to handle the rejection and the really small kind of insular Seattle scene. It when a scene is super small, everything is supportive. There's no hate. The only people who are coming to a show are people that are down to watch like a small local band.
Totally.
So as soon as you start to like get above that a little bit, you get exposed to the people who are just like, well, I don't care about this. Why am I seeing it?
Right, right.
And when you've never seen that before, it makes total sense why it would be like somewhat upsetting to have where you didn't do anything negative to this person, but he sees you as something negative seemingly no reason.
Yeah. And you're degrading like this kind of idea of what like it means. Like his bands, you know, are like really important apparently, you know, especially that time. Maybe it's like we're all younger. It's like you're desecrating some sacred thing of like grinding in the scene and like riding the, like, you know, and that we toured with bands later that kind of became, again, like the Pitchfork was like kind of the easy one to like how those kind of like the real like cool bands, I mean it's always existed, but that was like for our generation was the thing that really codified that. But we actually did stalk someone, and it was through Tracy. I just want to make sure I acknowledge this. We found out about Frank Nieto, who later became our publicist, and we did actually go and find him, and we kind of stalked him and like came out and gave him our demo after Throw Me the Statue show. And Throw Me the Statue was actually probably the band that canceled the headlining spot, I think, or at least that we were really trying to get them, and it was like looking like we could, and then they dropped off or something. They had Bumbershoot or something. I don't remember what all the details are, but Frank Nieto was like publicist for Grizzly Bear and Of Montreal. Of Montreal is like just, you know, ridiculous band at the time. He got it. He was like, oh, this is weird. This is interesting. He was like at first a little like reticent, but like it's kind of a publicist dream if you have that much of a backstory and you're that like kind of into the idea of making yourself absurd, then so eventually he agreed to like to be on, like we contracted him, like we'll you know, whatever, we'll save our, we had zero, like almost $0, we'll like, we need, of course, a publicist. Yeah. And he was like actually doing stuff, and so, and it worked, because he, like, we were getting little things in The Stranger, but then he was like filling in the gaps, and then he was the one who got us like kind of pulled into the real underworld of Seattle music we didn't know that much about, which is like the where our management and some of the other things started to come from. And you start to really learn, I mean, you learn how naive you are, and then you start to be like, oh, this is how it works. And that was like, you know, you're the first kind of thing of, it was really eye-opening. It's like him. And then I remember Tracy, who a manager wrote us, and Tracy like Googling them and being like, we'd researched Natalie Portman Shaved Head's manager. We were starting to be like, okay, managers, whatever. And then we looked her up and we're like, oh, she's like really legit. We really are onto something. People really want to like work with us. So
it's probably around this time Dead Oceans gets in contact with you.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it was a really fast everything.
Yeah.
By today's standards, like, I'm like, especially, you know, you have a family and you're just like, dude, it's like time moves at an entirely different rate. But at that, everything was moving really fast. And the timeline, I would say, so we booked the show. And before the show happened, we were signed on with Frank. And then through Frank, our management, which is this lady named Lynn Resnick, who's married to Adam Zaks, who started Sasquatch. And so I'm talking about like the where you see the things happening in the city. And I would say by the following March, we had already just like, maybe by fall, we had signed the deal, and then we released our record by March, because everybody was like, you got to go. So yeah, like legit, it was like July 31st was the first show. It must have been fall, like maybe October. I could go check. And then we recorded, and then released the album March 9th, I believe. I have a terrible memory, but I'm almost sure that's right. Yeah, and that was like the record release show, and like I think we played a show with Tokyo Police Club where Dead Oceans, Frank was remember that, as I mentioned earlier, he was working with Throw Me the Statue, and they were on Secretly, and so that's how, like, between that whole set of people that we were trying to get on Sub Pop. Tony wasn't having it, we were too silly for Sub Pop, and then I had never heard of Secretly Canadian. I had never heard of Pitchfork. I never heard of, I mean, again, I was like very green, and
One, all of it was new still.
Yeah, it was really...
The blogosphere is only a couple years old,
100%.
Maybe.
Yeah. And like I said, I wasn't fast-tracked into it. I was like pretty like... You get something in The Stranger, that's like a big deal. You're like, mm-hmm. Oh my God. And it's in print and you're like, wow. The Rock, I grew up... Yeah, The Rocket. All those things were the things that were important to me. But yeah, then they were like, hey, this label... Dead Oceans is interested in signing you guys. They flew out. Phil flew out and watched us play with Tokyo Police Club, opening for them or something. And again, band names, you know, whatever. And apparently we were. I mean, you can't say objectively, but like I think like yeah, the band was like really silly in name and like the whole idea. But we were like we worked really hard. We rehearsed like almost every single day, if not multiple times a day during stretches. So and Marshall was exceptionally gifted as a drummer, so I would have never done it if I didn't think he was good. Like he really had a lot of things that he was struggling with in his life, just the cards he was dealt, and it was just the miracle of like, wow, you're really good at this thing. And
well, it's also point. Sorry to cut you off there, but like at this point, you're probably like mid 20s, and this is becoming overwhelming for you. Marshall's 13.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's totally bizarre. But yeah, it was like this thing where I was like, well, maybe this is the route. Like, I didn't come from money. I come from a lot of like, whatever, you know, you could, who doesn't? But like, I guess some people. But I had a lot of stuff in my background. Marshall had a lot of stuff in his background. And to me, it was like, oh, this thing might work. Maybe this is our ticket out of here. And for him especially, it was like, I was like, okay, cool. I can kind of keep him traveling, and like this is like my dream, and it's like he loves it. He was always like he wanted to start this band. It seemed like something. So like, to me, and again, I was naive. I was in my 20s and like raising a kid that I shouldn't have been raising. You know what I mean? Yeah. In a lot of ways. And so, but I'm like this ridiculous like dreamer. I'm like, oh, this. You know, you have an idea, and you're like, well, of course I have to do it. You know, so and it was working. So I was like, well, I'm fully justified now. The universe has given me the green light. Let's go. So yeah, that was, and Phil came out. So sorry, jumping back, trying to use continuity, which I'm not the best at. But in fall, I think, and we signed, and then we released at Numo's, I believe, with Say Hi, if I'm right. Yeah. We did our record release show 2009. And then again, everything that, from the moment we basically decided we were doing that Numo show, like nothing really stopped or slowed down. Because even when we were back, we were writing. It was like it was pretty insane for the entirety of like that first chunk of what the band actually probably was.
Yeah. I do want to get into the band's kind of newer music soon, but there are a couple follow up things here. So again, like I'm sure like one of the big kind of spotlights on the band is that you have a super young kid and the band is now traveling across the country. Right. And I've interviewed other bands on here who maybe they have members that are under 21, and we've talked about the challenges of like where. Most music venues and probably a lot of the venues you were playing, they're bars and clubs where
for sure
for some of them, like maybe you're only allowed in the venue when you're on stage and then you have to stay outside. So like
all of our shows, every show we ever played.
I would love to hear about that dynamic.
Until you're
trying to do that. Like you're trying to build a community for Marshall where he's not allowed to interact with people, but you also want to keep him away from, I'm sure, the rock and roll debauchery.
Right.
Yeah. There's a lot of layers to all this and all of it's new.
Yeah. And he wasn't really super interested. He was like Marshall's a wild, like he was a wild kid in a lot of ways. Like maybe that'll be another episode, but he's so chill now. Like he's much different, but he was a really like it was an interesting thing to do and yes there were like the laws are all varying and like the ways that you do things and then this idea of like being at a hotel and like you're poor and sharing rooms but like the venue thing in particular though is like you could make if we had like our own show, we could sometimes make it dry in the green room so he could chill there. That was like mostly what we aimed for, but a lot of time it would be like you got to sit in the van with someone, you know what I mean? And it was just a really strange lifestyle. And once I remember he also looked really old. So I'll tell you two quick stories about it. One, we were on tour and with Japan Droids, I think. And I think it was in Canada. I don't remember, but we played with this band called the Coat Hangers. And it's like an all girl, like I think punk band. And they didn't know anything because we were on tour with them. They didn't know anything about Marshall. So I like open the green room door and it's a cloud of smoke that just billows out or whatever. And I was like, Marshall, what are you doing? And he's just sitting there Marshall loved being in people's green rooms, like eating their food. Like it's the best. Like I'll tell another story in a second. Cause they're like my favorite thing. But so anyway, like these girls were talking to him, like, oh yeah, we love him. They knew he was young. We're like, how old is he? And I was like 14. They're like, oh my God, we're so sorry. It was like that was like happened many times for people. Marshall's just like having the time of his life. He's not like getting high or anything. That came later, but and not in the band, but that was like kind of like the thing that we would encounter sometimes. It was actually like kind of cute. And then the other story is actually hilarious, is that we were in like Missoula or something, and Marshall had to go sit in the van. I think we were playing maybe a festival or something, I couldn't find him, and he wasn't in the van. It wasn't in the venue. And then I went to the doorman and I was like, hey, have you seen my little brother anywhere? I don't know why I phrased it like that, because that's how I would ask about Marshall. And he's like, not unless your little brother's like a 30-year-old black dude. And I was like,
that's him.
That's him. It's like people thought he was way older than he was. And I looked really young. So it was like just doubly confusing. But yeah, we had a lot of interesting scenarios, and it was a very irregular childhood, because yeah, he would come back from tour and just be like in middle school in like going to Roosevelt, and his friends would be like, did you go on tour with Portugal the Man? And I'd be like, yeah, because he would lie about every, you know, he would lie about so many things, and then like, but then like the things that were like the most like lie worthy were actually true. So I'd be like, yeah,
that's amazing. So I'm sure he was like homeschooled on the road and just like,
yeah.
And that's maybe just boring logistic stuff. We can keep things focused on the band, yeah. But I'm sure a lot of people are fascinated by like, you can't just pull a kid out of school for six months.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, so I don't think Marshall would care if I said this, but like Marshall has like a lot of like cognitive, like learning disabilities.
Sure.
And so like that part of the reason I started like helping raise him is sort of like homeschooling him part of the time. And we in and out of co-ops, just different things, experiments. He got in trouble all the time. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is just genuinely like, hyperactivity, all these different things, neurodivergence. And at that time, like people didn't really talk about it like they do now. And so I was just like, well, I've been like helping raise him since he was like a three. So like in a lot of ways, he's like my child. And so I was like, well, I'll just keep him with me. He was good. He loves drums or whatever. But then the homeschooling thing is like, I was doing that off and on anyway. And it was really helpful because he got one-on-one instruction. I was going to school for, you know, education and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, if you think about it though, in a lot of ways, I mean, he got to go to like, we would be in New York City and we'd go to the Metropolitan, you know, like music or Metropolitan Museum. And then we'd be like we'd be in Alabama playing in Birmingham. We'd go to Civil Rights Museum. You know, it's like we would be exploring so many different things that like, that's what people are like kind of like pushing in a lot of schools, like wanting kids to be able to see and experience things. And so there were definitely like some points that, you know, I wasn't as strong in, but he definitely was like every day in the van. That was like point of great contention, but like, we were just like, doing his homework together, doing geography. Like, we're in this city now. You know, now we're in this city. We're going to study, you know, capitals and things about that and write essays about different things. So it was always related. It's like the curriculum was really interesting. So, sorry, I know you're saying that wasn't a question, but to me, actually, again, very, like, unique and profound. And I think that, like, it served him really well just because his life experience was so diverse, so different than his peers that, like, just from everything from eating at different restaurants, of seeing different places, he'd been to like every state essentially. So
no, it totally qualifies as being part, like, yeah. In addition to you guys just having great music, the human interest story of the band is totally a factor that I think has captured people's attention.
Totally.
And at this point, everything sounds like it's fun. It's going well. And then that probably stops at a certain point.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I'm glad we talked about all the early stuff because it's all significant and all ties together. But I think that, so we almost sold out the first show, and there were a lot of things involved in that. One of it was just like, we spent a lot of time and energy being really creative and promoting the show. So more so than I've ever done in my life. And I've done a lot of different things like that, but we almost sold it out, and we had a lot of attention. Then we signed to Dead Oceans, which again was a big deal. I just didn't really know it as much. I just knew that people were telling me it was good. And then we were getting on like pretty good tours. Like we toured with Cursive. Like it was like one of my favorite bands. So like that was the moment where I was like, okay. And then people that I was close to were starting to be like weird to me. And like there are people in the music scene that, yeah, started to become a little more aggressively like critical or jealous or whatever. And so... that was, it's just, yeah, it was eye opening. We were like, I remember going to like Sub Pop's 20th anniversary in the Space Needle. It must have been the 20th, but like, we can date check me if we want. But like, just being in the Space Needle, like, seeing the thermals, and we're all drinking like champagne, and like, I don't know, it's just like a different world. Like, nobody cared about me before that. Nobody. And suddenly it was like, I at least had like a little bit of access. And it just really changes you. You're just like, oh, this is what people are doing. This is how you get into this thing. So, of course, we're going to play Sasquatch. Do you know what I mean? I believe that they genuinely thought we were good and fun and, like, whatever. But, like, yeah, it's pretty obvious in a lot of ways. So then, yeah, you're up in a the Space Needle and seeing people. And you're just like, it's just weird. But yeah.
It's an ego boost.
It is an ego boost. And it was like, yeah, just... getting more money for shows and just things that like, yeah, you're like, in a lot of ways, I was like, I did it. And I did it, you could say either, you know, it's like, because the story was so outrageous that worked, or we did it because like we did it, you know, nobody ever really fully knows how things, you know, what the reason is, but like, it seemed like people liked the music and like that we had played really good shows and I suddenly was there. So it didn't really matter, I guess, at a certain point, but yeah, it's really eye-opening, and things were still going okay-ish, but we got, like, dealt our first major blow, which was a Pitchfork review. And that had the, like...
That was for the second album?
No, the first album. Okay. And that was, like, I don't remember where we were at the time. I think we were on tour, and... I just didn't really know what it all was. I mean, I knew people got bad reviews, you know, but like we had just been, everything had been so positive leading up there, except for like your Eric Grandes, but he was just a kind of a douche at the time anyway. You just expected it. But this was the first time I was like, wow, we were in all of these different magazines, including like Spin. We had this like nice article where they were like praising us. So I was like, okay, people seem to like us, you know. And then that was the first thing that was like, it was brutal. And there were other bands in town even who got like got bad reviews from Pitchfork. It was kind of the thing at the time, but it was particularly menacing for me because I think that like we started to see the impact immediately as far as like how hard it was to get certain festivals, certain shows, and like what I felt like the energy change was, but also like people will come up to me after shows and be like, "Hey, I read your Pitchfork review. I actually really like you guys, but I didn't think I would." And you're like, what the fuck? Like, what is it? Like, so it just, again, it just like that started to, and then just being on tour, we were doing long tours. And so that was like, it was starting to kind of like, you're starting to wear yourself a little thin and you know it, but like everyone was pushing, especially for the first album. We were like, get it out. Cause you guys have a buzz right now. That's like the whole thing at the time. I don't know if people still use it, but like a buzz band. And we were South by Southwest, play 8 showcases in a day, you know, you're like on the verge of heat stroke and you're just in this, like this machine and like, it's all you've ever wanted to do. And suddenly you're like, it's so cliche, but you're like, I'm just going to do anything, whatever we have to do. We're driving through blizzards to get to Day Trotter. People are in your ear. Just be like, you got to get there. You got to be safe. You got to, you know, but you still have to make it there. So get through the blizzard. There's like jackknife semis everywhere. He's like, I want to play at Day Trotter because it's apparently part of my dream. I didn't know it existed, but I want to do it now. So anyway, long story short, that was like the beginning of some of the things. I mean, one of the most memorable things ever though, like for me would be like, and eternally in praise of them was, like Cursive was like, we submitted to be on that tour. And, one of the things that they told us when we met them, they're like, they asked if we were a Pitchfork band. Because maybe they had heard of the buzz or like people had or whatever. But like the fact that we had just suffered that blow to our kind of ego and momentum and that Cursive like was glad that we weren't was like a real like thing that kind of was like, all right, maybe there's life after this, because it was pretty dire. You know, it felt like you kind of, it's like the Scarlet Letter or something. So anyway, we went on that tour.
Well, it's just not a hit to like your music. Like, you tie so much of your personal identity into music, and I'm not just speaking about you. That's musicians in general.
Oh, for sure.
So when someone doesn't like your music, if you're, I don't know, an architect and someone doesn't like a building you made, you can maybe brush that off. But like
my family. And you know, I don't know if I use it as a crutch or not, but like, again, the spirit of the band was really just to like get out to do this thing. And like, I was very ambitious for sure. But it, like, I was like, you guys are really like, kind of like, you're kind of fucking over this band that like, we're goofy, but like, please not us. Like, this is not the way, like, you don't know where we come from. And I think that was like the beginning of like some of the heartbreak for me. Which is like, honestly, always stayed with me, because I was like, oh man, it's like, you just take that hit and you have to take those hits. But for me, I could kind of see it for what it was. I was like, oh, this could be a big deal. And then just money, you know, we didn't have money. And like, I was like substitute teaching at this point. I like could, you have to, in order to tour. None of us have money. None of us came from money. And so, you know, like, we got off the tour with Cursive, and we were like exhausted, and then got an email being like, do you want to come on another tour with us? I mean, which is, again, like, you have to understand like how important that was to me. And we had to say no, because we just could not afford it. And so it was just like things like that started to happen. And then we were on tour with Japandroids, who were like best new music. So it was just like a total mind fuck. You're like worst new music and best new music. Those guys are great. It was really like, it was really fun and very memorable. But like, that was just like that era, you know, that really like, before your next question, which hope maybe this like is a bit of a segue, because it gets worse. But a lot of the reaction, I think what happened to me personally, And Jared is like kind of said as well, like, to him, like, the one of the other members quit. It was like too much for him. And then I get more hardcore. So I'm like, well, we're not like, yeah, the whole thing was silly and it was like what we needed to do, but we're a real band. And like, you know, Marshall's getting older and like we can do all this cool stuff. Like, you know, I feel like we could make a really good album, like a really like serious. I want people to know who we are. And I was also going like, just like, things are kind of dark in our lives in a lot of different ways anyway. And I didn't quite realize it in things in the past, but I started like, I was obsessed with certain novels and writing, and you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to make this like kind of concept album, which again is like, someone should have been really truly pulled me aside, but I was like headlong into it. I'm going to make an album that's going to redeem the redemption arc. Pitchfork, you know, prepare yourself. World, well, they won't think, we'll get rid of the uniforms, we'll play ball. And so anyway, that's the setup to like the second era where, yeah, things kind of got a little bit worse, or a lot worse, I guess.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.